But she does a really good job. She got there quickly. We're going to open a public hearing, call order of the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education as of today, April 9th. So just to give you a little update, because we've been having conversations with people who could or couldn't get here in time, some trapped on freeways. So we're going to do a, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 84 to Tuesday. It's already been scheduled for there. So we will not be hearing Senate Bill 84 today. Senate Bill 113, we're going to work. It's a bill we've already heard before. Then we're going to move to Senate Bill 536 and Senate Bill 930.
14.
And then we're going to do 418. Hopefully the person that's trapped in traffic right now will be here by then. And then we will go to Senate Bill 895 for the rest of the session. The others are fairly short. So that's just so people have an idea of how it's we're going to move through the today. So with that, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 113. We'll have a short explanation of what we've done to this bill, because it's different than it was when the last time we heard it.
Sure. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 113, as introduced, requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to determine definitions for employee categories at post-secondary education institutions. The Dash 2 amendments, which we're considering today, replace this measure and require instead that HEC convene a work group to determine a method for public universities and community colleges to report relevant employment data in a consistent and a detailed manner. We have a fiscal impact statement issued. It's estimated at about $56,000 for the 2015-17 biennium, and a no revenue impact statement has been issued for the Dash 2 amendments.
And in this committee, we've been very consistent. If it gets over 50, we send it down to Ways and Means so that they can have a look at it, because 50,000 after 10 or 15 bills that are 50,000 actually comes up to be money that affects us.
A long time ago, there was a senator by the name of Everett Dirksen.
Yeah, from, that's right.
And I remember the quote I remember from him, of course, this is Congress, and he said, you know, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money.
That's right. So we try to keep that pretty consistent in this particular. So I will open a work session. Did I already do that?
I think
work
you did.
Session? Yeah, I did. So, Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments as presented.
Senator Canope moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? The amendments are adopted. Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 113 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 113 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. So we don't have to, so as I said, they go pretty quick. So.
Sometimes.
So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 113, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 536. And this is one of our members here. We're going to go get the sheet that has the names on it who signed up. And do you want to start with an explanation, Senator Cruz, or do you want to just call the...
I'm going to let the certified experts. I just want to say that we had, not Jim, you are. This is a product of an interim work group that we had, and the thing that I regret, because we're kind of squeezed on the when we got the bill drafted, that I did not have all of the members of that work group sign on to the bill, but there will be opportunity to do that. So this is kind of redesigning some of the structure, administrative structure in the education system, and Jim is the expert in the field. So
thank you for being here, Jim. For identify yourself for the record, and you can tell us a little bit about this bill and what it does.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jim Mabbitt. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association of ESDs and was appointed to serve on this task force, the legislative task force, which was named the Regional Service Delivery Task Force. We had 10 members on that team. Among those, we were thrilled to have four legislators, two of whom are sitting on your panel today, Senator Beyer, Senator Cruz. We had Representative Nathanson and Representative Wisnett. And it was a really great committee, and we met quite a few times over about a year and a half, and I think did some fine work. This is an issue. I'll describe the issue in a second. But this is an issue that's been talked about in Oregon for a long time, and nothing really had come of it in terms of legislation. And what I'm talking about there is looking at cost efficiencies in the state, cost efficiencies that school districts, community colleges, and education service districts can take advantage of to, in my view, not only possibly increase their service in certain areas, but certainly decrease costs and save dollars for the classroom where the money belongs. There are certain areas of the state that in regions that have looked at cost efficiencies and have made some strong decisions and pooled resources, but not nearly enough. We want to give folks an opportunity. Many of the regions don't really know what to look for or how to look for it. And our group felt that we should give them an opportunity to do that. So, this committee looked at a whole number of topics to discuss. One of those, just on a side note, was health services and getting health services closer to students. We decided that belonged in another area, and Senator Cruz was really helpful in that, to get that going, and there's legislation this session about that. So that was kind of an indirect result of our work. But then we zeroed in on this particular topic because it's so important with the way resources are scarce today, and we know that over the last many years, many teachers have been cut from classrooms, and we thought that if you look at back office functions, and I still call them that because that's what I always will call them, you're looking at business offices, human resources, technology, those kinds of areas, there is money to be saved. We've seen proof of that in the state. So the committee put together the draft for Senate Bill 536, the language for it, and decided that a number of about $300,000 would be a number that we could really get some good work started for next biennium. If there are regions looking to save money within business and fiscal activities, human resources, professional development, legal services, and technology programs, those are the areas that are outlined in the bill. The Department of Education would award those grants to bring in a team of experts who would look at the areas that that region identified. If it was just business office functions, the team we'd get a team that had expertise in that area. If it was two or more areas, we'd bring a variety of experts in to take a look. Mm-hmm. I have talked to a number of folks around the state since this bill was drafted. I know there's interest in looking at this issue. We had a superintendent on our committee, and he said, you know, sometimes it takes a little push to get people to look at this because it is a sensitive issue. Quite frankly, where the savings comes from is eliminating positions and have a smaller number of people when you look at volume, and that's what we want to look at. Is we all know that a business office, for instance, in a small district or a small ESD, we can have a larger organization work with a region larger than their own organization, many times without adding any staff at all, but certainly adding fewer staff members than would be combined at some of the smaller organizations. We also put into this bill, intent anyway, that we wanted to make sure that if there were employees displaced as a result of this work, that every opportunity would be made to hire them into the new organization or the large organization who would be taking over those duties. I am thrilled that this is here in front of you today. I hope that you take a strong look at this and understand that there are dollars to be saved, and long term, the amount of money that can be saved for the state of Oregon is exponentially larger than $300,000 if regions will really become serious about these studies, and I believe they are. If we don't have anyone, we don't have any takers at all, you've risked nothing because the state won't spend a dime. But if there are takers, I believe we're going to have tremendous savings in any region that takes us up on the offer. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Beyer.
Did you want to go first? Well, Jim, thank you for sort of leading this charge. Besides, you did a lot of work over the time, and I think I was impressed as we look at it how much good work there's already going on. I think there's always a perception that schools are not, you know, doing the best, saving as much money as they can. And what we learned is that, particularly among the smaller districts, that there's an awful lot of collaboration and sharing going on. And I think we started off with the idea of, there's always the idea of, should we just do away with education service districts and all that? And we found out that they're really playing an incredible role in compiling some of these, and in some unusual ways, in unusual configurations. When you think about the state, it isn't always the same region that some of this work is being done, largely because of the availability of electronic information sharing. So I think it's very good. And as Jim said, we've seen a lot of savings, and we've seen a lot of potential for more. And I guess one of the things that I've learned over the years is, you know, there's always the attempt by the legislature to try and tell the 197 districts how they ought to do things, and that's almost always met with local control and get out of our way. This is a different approach, just showing them the way, which they have already demonstrated that when they're not told to do something and just have to do it out of financial necessity or a good service, it seems to work. And this is just a very small amount of money, a small attempt to try and nudge that along, as Jim said, and I think it makes a lot of sense and it has a lot of promise.
Senator Cruz.
We've actually been working on this for more than a year and a half. Okay.
I wasn't counting all those other times.
Okay. Well, I will, because I was there. The first thing I want to say is the issue on the health care systems that are in schools. That's both school nurses and school-based health centers. We are passing legislation to get a better idea of the construct there. The Department of Ed is going to be doing that work. Because quite honestly, some CCOs are already taking it over, others are not, but the fact that we're using formula dollars for things that, for the most part, are either Medicaid or CHIP matchable doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So we are, Representative Nathanson and I decided to take that in a different direction, which we did. But, you know, Mr. Chair, it's like Douglas County has 13 school districts. Roseburg's big. The rest of them are small. Okay, for each one of those small districts to have payroll, HR, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make sense. And so what we're offering school districts is a real way to save some money and get some efficiencies. And from my perspective, I think it, in a lot of the state, we're going to expand the work of the ESDs because they kind of tend to be what I think people would assume to be the hub of these activities, because not only don't the local school districts like to be told what to do, especially the little ones, they don't like to turn their stuff over to their neighbor school district. So ESD is a neutral place for those sort of things to happen. So I actually expect us to get some very positive results out of this.
Other discussions? I guess what I would say is that I absolutely agree that once you get them to give up one thing, then the real conversation starts happening, because mm-hmm. they build trust, and then they can look at other opportunities to do that. But you've got to have that first one be successful, and I think this bill is designed to allow those to be successful, because they have the experts there to help them set it up.
And also because it's totally voluntary and we're not forcing anybody, because Jim talked about this is eliminating FTE in a lot of places, but this would allow the local districts, if they have a payroll clerk in their district that's 3 years from retirement, they can plan to turn those services over upon and just not refill that position. So it gives them total flexibility in how they handle this.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Jim, for being here.
Well, just one more comment,
yes,
if I may.
Please.
When I finally had a chance after all these years to have that gavel, I want Senator Cruz and Senator Beyer to acknowledge that I didn't abuse that at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 536? There was no one else on the list, so I don't see anyone. We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 536, and we don't have all the paperwork we need to actually work this bill, so we have it scheduled, I think. Yeah. So with that, we will close the public hearing on 536, which I did, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 930. And with that, we'll have a short explanation, and we could have Jim, you had a group that you want to bring up, your group of two or three other people with you.
Which one? 930.
And we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 930 modifies the method by which the minimum amount is distributed for education service districts. And the way that it is calculated, that it declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. This bill has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue. We are not considering amendments at this time. This bill may have a fiscal and may have a revenue impact, but statements have not yet been issued.
Thank you very much. So who wants to start the conversation?
I will start, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You.
Mr. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Gary Peterson, Superintendent of Columbia Gorge Education Service District in the Dalles, and here today representing the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts, of which I am the president. OESD unanimously supports Senate Bill 930. We believe that it provides equity for those of the smallest ESDs in the state, and thus the school districts and the students they serve, and we will have some examples of that from two of our smaller ESD superintendents. At this point, I turn it over to Jim to talk a little bit about some of the specifics and the background relative to 930.
Slide over the end. Thank you. And you don't have to be that close. You're fine. You can relax.
Yeah, that's good. I like to relax. Again, my name is Jim Abbott. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts. This is a bill that is necessary because we have our smallest five ESDs that for the last 12 years have been receiving what we've sometimes referred to as a $1 million floor or a $1 million ceiling or however you want to word that. But $1 million going to each one of those ESDs to operate. But now they have collectively gone beyond where that revenue doesn't anymore take care of the expenditures. And so they're having to spend down some dollars that they managed to save up just like every other organization in the state. But that's not going to last very long. And before I give you the history on this, I just want to make the bottom line statement. The fact is if we don't do anything for these five ESDs now, they're going to be in, and they are now, what we used to refer to as the safety net back in the 80s. They will not receive any more increases, and they'll be continuing to go behind in terms of their revenue versus expenditures. Those ESDs are Grant, Harney, Lake, North Central, and Wallawa. As I mentioned, in 2003, that's when the $1 million service grant started to each of them. And that decision was made because we know that those ESDs are located in some of the most remote and sparsely populated areas of the state, that the normal formula would not allow them to operate at an effective level at all. They cannot do that because of the amount of money that they receive because of the student population they have. But as all of you know, in some of those areas, the geographic regions are huge, but the populations really aren't, and it really causes a dilemma. Because that legislation was put in place, it really helped those five ESDs, but there was no mechanism put in place at all to allow for any sort of rising costs or inflationary erosion. So being flat funded for 12 years, it's worked during that time, but doesn't anymore. Expenses have caught up with that allocation, and they can no longer afford to continue flat funding. And what I mean by they can't afford is the school districts in their regions and the students they serve can't afford that, because services will continue to drop if they're in the safety net, so to speak. All other educational entities in the state received a funding gain in 2013-15, and I assume will again in 2015-17. Without this bill passing, those ESDs will fall just that much farther behind. Senate Bill 933 would modify the annual funding level in all five of those ESDs and would establish an updated funding level for those, as well as index that level based on future changes in ESD funding. And that's a very important point, because what we wanted to do is say, let's solve this once and for all, and say that those ESDs, once they received this additional bump, would now be tied to ESD funding up or down as the years go forward. As I mentioned, they were flat funded up until now, so if there was an increase or a decrease, that their amount did not change. From now on, whatever amount is allocated to them would be indexed to ESD funding. The Senate Bill 933 proposes a $100,000 increase for each of the five ESDs. This amount was the result of a consensus process that was ultimately supported by all 15 of the ESD member districts, two of them who are sitting here, and with Harney and Lake ESD, and it represents a compromise, and that's important for you all to know. There was a tremendous discussion over weeks, months, I'd say, trying to find out what number could be tolerated, because the way we proposed it is, and the way it's proposed in the bill, is that the dollars that would be increased to the two ESDs sitting in front of you here, that money would come directly out of the other ESDs. No money added anywhere from Salem. So it would come out of the other ESDs. The other three ESDs, Grant, North Central, and Wallawa, they are in a unique situation in that their local revenue far exceeds what they would receive from the formula. So they give back dollars every year into the state school fund. What would happen there on that $300,000 is they would give back $300,000 less than they have in the past. And so that $300,000 would be shared across all ESDs and school districts in the state. It's the only way we can really do that. The $200,000 that would come directly out of the other 14 ESDs would be at a cost of 30 cents per ADMW. And as I mentioned, all of the ESDs within our organization have approved that and agreed to that, even though some of the middle and larger ESDs are, it's a fair chunk of change, but they've agreed to it. The $300,000 for Grant, North Central, Wallawa would amount to 2 cents per ADMW across the entire state of school districts and ESDs, a fairly negligible amount. Under this bill, each of those three ESDs would send $100,000 less annually to the state school fund, as I mentioned before, those three. This bill, I can't tell you how important it is, and it's not important, I'm sure, to the great majority of the state, but it's hugely important to those school districts that live inside those five ESDs and those students they serve. I strongly urge that you move this bill forward, keeping in mind that the amount for school districts is negligible, and the amount to ESDs has been agreed to by all of our members. So with that, I will turn it over to Charlie, and he can tell you a little bit about what's happening at Harney ESD and why this bill is needed.
I'm Charlie Beck. I'm the superintendent of Harney ESD in Burns, Oregon. What's happened over the course of the last decade is there has been no reduction in the kinds of services that our component districts need for us to provide. in order to maintain those services, what we've had to do is reduce staff, and everybody does a little more. I've been there for a couple of years, and in the time that I've been there, we've had to reduce by one administrator and one executive secretary position in order to maintain the special ed work, the technology work, the finance work, and some of the other work that we do. Just this year, for example, one of our component districts was having some financial difficulty and asked us to take care of all of their finances. So since November, we've been serving as a fiscal agent in total for one of our districts. And those are just the kinds of things that happen. We provide de facto administrative services for seven of our rural districts that have no administration. They just have one or two teachers. And when they have administrative issues that come up, we're kind of the only people for them to turn to. So when they have parent issues or student issues or policy issues, we get phone calls from them to help them out with those kinds of things. I think the other comment that I would make is I've been a part of large ESDs. My wife's an employee of Multnomah ESD in Portland. I was associated with a High Desert ESD when I was administrator in Ben Lapine School District. And I can see the kinds of things that you can do if your income rises as the need rises. When I got to Harney ESD, it was a shock to me that there had been no increase in revenue, but there had certainly been an increase in the kinds of demands that were placed on the ESD. The people in Harney ESD and Lake ESD, Grant ESD, Wallowa ESD, and North Central ESD are working very, very hard to try to make up for that lack of revenue over the last decade. So I heartily endorse this. I also need to say a thank you to all of my fellow ESD superintendents in this state. All of them have endorsed this also. And it is a fiscal burden to them. The dollars that will go to Bob and I's ESD are coming out of their ESDs. But I think they acknowledge that our ESDs are suffering somewhat from the fact that we've had no increase in the last decade or so. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Nash. I'm the superintendent of the Lake County Education Service District in Lakeview, Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Lake County Education Service District serves the needs of just over 1,200 students in Oregon's third largest county. We're a very traditional ESD focusing on direct services to our students, in particular, special education. We partner with our school districts in some of Oregon's smallest, most rural communities, places such as Plush, Adel, Christmas Valley, and Paisley, to support our most vulnerable students. The Lake County ESD provides itinerant special education, speech, counseling, school psychology, and early childhood special education services to these remote areas. Our employees traveled over 59,000 miles last year to work with students throughout our county. We are extremely grateful for the $1 million funding that the legislature provided for the five small ESDs in 2003. This funding allowed us to continue to provide essential services to our students. However, in recent years, the lack of increased revenue has made it difficult to maintain our service levels. Since 2003, we have lost a little over $200,000 in revenue when adjusted for inflation. During the same time, our special education caseloads have increased by 6%. And our costs overall have increased significantly. For example, since 2003, the average cost of one of our licensed staff members has increased 46%. As a result, we've had to reduce staff by 14%. As Charlie mentioned, primarily we've done this in areas of administration and office support. We've also had to cut about $100,000 in programs for our students, programs such as reading support, drama, distance learning, professional development, student enrichment, and library support. Senate Bill 930 will not restore all of these cuts, but it will help us reverse the cuts in special education, speech, and school psychology so we can continue to provide the core services to our school districts. Lake County ESD supports Senate Bill 930 because it's a modest increase that will allow us to continue current service levels. It's supported by the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts. It does not require any increase in the state school fund, and it's indexed to the future funding for all ESDs. Thank you very much.
Any questions for this group? So I guess my question is this, the way you're getting the money, whether it comes from the other ESDs or from the extra resources that come into the ESDs, is that the way it will go with the index, or is there a different formula for the index?
It's the way it'll work that way, and so what will happen is that there'll be a change at the state level of how ESDs are funded proportionally, and so these ESDs will get a little bit more, and the other ESDs will get a little bit less, and then as ESD funding from there in future bienniums goes up or down, then it'll just be consistently at, as it is now, except these five would be now indexed like all the other ones are.
But the money that they're using for that increase in the index, will it come from the same source, or will it come from the general?
It'll come from the same source.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't foresee a time when the two districts that bring in more and send more get to the point where they are receiving districts instead of sending districts with respect to their resources?
No.
I wouldn't want to have to take the decrease because they couldn't send enough money.
The differential is so huge.
Okay.
That's not going to happen.
Okay. Wind farms and other things in comparison to... Yeah, that's what it sounded like that. Other questions of the superintendents or the others?
Makes sense.
Yeah, Jim can. Did you want to also say something in the middle? Did you want any more?
Okay. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Is there... Okay. No other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nope. Did we get everybody? Was there anybody else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 930? I see no one else. So we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 930. And are we okay? But before that, would you like to vote on 113, which is Denver's bill, extending it to Ways and Means to be a asking Heck to look into the come up with the answer to what different kinds of
moving right along.
What the heck? So they're trying to figure out how to categorize the people that believe they're not
good doctor.
We don't have a fiscal. We just sent Ways and Means.
It's in your house.
Sorry.
Okay. One additional person.
What happens when you have two doctors?
Oh, one more person for the other Senate bill. I'll reopen the hearing for Senate Bill 536. I forget there's people outside.
536 or
930? Which one, 930? 536.
930.
We'll close the 536 and open Senate Bill 930 public hearing. Sorry about that. Didn't know. Didn't catch it.
That's all right, Senator. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I represent North Central Grant and Wallowa ESDs, and I live in Condon. And I want to make one point clear that may not have been clear in prior testimony, is that North Central Grant and Wallowa do not belong to the Oregon Association of ESDs. So they don't represent our interests, let me put it that way. We represent our own. And I also want to make it clear, and I don't want to confuse this issue, but I'm not here to oppose the purpose of Senate Bill 930. What we disagree with is the methodology by which they reached the numbers, okay? $100,000 by Mr. Mabbitt's testimony was reached as a matter of consensual process, and it was a compromise. Well, okay. I would infer from that's all that was involved in the calculation of that number. In other words, they negotiated with themselves and were able to reach a compromise between nothing and something. There's a similar bill in the House Bill 3497, that was introduced by North Central Grant and Wallowa. And I don't want to harp on that because we're testifying on 930 here. That I understand.
No problem.
But in order to use the amounts on for comparison, just percentages of comparison, because I don't want to leave the committee with the illusion that we're talking about a lot of money here, regardless of how much we're talking about. It's $100,000. Senate Bill 3497 or House Bill 3497 What it does, the calculation behind that is say that the state school fund increased 36% between 2003 and 2014. So that had we been indexed to the state school fund, the current $1 million FERA would be $1,360,000. That's simple. That's what it costs to bring the Frontier ESDs into parity with all the other ESDs in the state. It's cut and dried, very simple deal. That's what the other bill says, $360,000. $1,360,000 for each of the five Frontier Rural ESDs, and I do not represent Harney and Lake. That, you know, let's make that clear as well. I don't. At $1,800,000 for all three ESDs, that's the annual increase, right? That's 0.77% of the ESD allocation at a number of $7.235 billion. 0.77%. I mean, burdens are burdens, and I understand that people's perception of what a burden is different. I wouldn't consider that to be a burden. Further, if you carry that on out, and you use a $360,000 number, or $1,360,000 times five, which is $6,800,000, that's 2.9% of the projected ESD allocation at 4.5% in 15-16 for all five ESDs. 2.9%. So you're funding 26% of the ESDs with 2.9% of the ESD allocation. So I mean, and. The proportionality is important here. Is that a lot of money? Well, in the overall picture, no. It's a rounding error. It's barely even a rounding error. But proportionally, it's extremely important to the smaller districts. So, I mean, there's some justification there that we feel has to be revisited. So what I would respectfully suggest today is that because there's a similar bill in the House, and I have I've offered to enter into negotiations with the association on behalf of my ESDs and the superintendents thereof. And so far we haven't been able to reach any agreement with respect to whether or not we're going to even sit down at the table. Are we that far apart? I don't know. I mean, you could make a case for that we're not that far apart, right? So, I mean, and I'm willing to compromise, willing to sit down, that's fine. Let's look at this, see if we can hammer out a deal, because my premise was, when I talked to the OESD representative before, was that let's not sit here and fight this battle. Let's not sit here and they oppose 3497 and I oppose 930, and we all get, and you guys are sitting up there saying, really? You couldn't reach a compromise, so you're wasting our time with two bills instead of one. That was my feeling about that. So I made an effort to be able, to bring you one bill. We still may be able to do that. So it's what I said. I would suggest that perhaps you might want to let 930 sit until we can figure out where we are, both with negotiation with OESD and with House Bill 3497-1, so that if there's a compare and contrast opportunity, then let's do that, as opposed to trying to run competing bills in both chambers. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
The only thing that I would say is that there is a clock in the legislature.
There is.
That on the 21st of April, if we haven't come to any compromise and neither one of these bills moves, it's all over and you get $1 million each.
That I understand.
Okay.
That was also, Mr. Chair, that was also part of my premise to begin with. We have a hearing a possible work session on 3497 in the House on Monday. So, and then I understand that the next deadline we've got is the 21st. So
okay.
I'm up to speed on that. But
okay.
I just
want to make sure.
You telling me. I know. I thank you that.
So our intention is then not move the bill today.
Okay.
To set it aside and then revisit it with a work session at a future date when we find out what the revenue forecast and other things are. So I guess I'm telling you that would, if you can come up with that issue, great, and we'll figure out where we're at. And I'll talk to my friends in the House as well.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we'll close the session on Senate Bill 930. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 418. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator. And Senator, do you want to say a few words? Or I think this is your bill, is it not?
Oh, I was getting excited that one of my bills was going to pass, and then I found out it was being gutting stuff. So,
is that right?
Yeah.
So I do like, yeah, we could do that.
You approve of the gutting stuff.
So do you want to – we'll give a short explanation by our administrator.
Yeah.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 418 directs the State Board of Education to adopt specified standards related to student education records. It provides that parents have the right to excuse a student from statewide standardized summative assessments and that school districts must provide notice of that right to parents. However, the Dash 2 amendments replace the original measure. These Dash 2s prohibit the State Board of Psychologist Examiners from discriminating against a doctoral program in psychology or an institution of higher education that houses a doctoral program in psychology based on location of the program or the institution and based on whether the program or institution offers online courses or requires students to complete courses on the campus of the institution.
So with that, we will call up. Oh, yeah. There we go. Linda Gardner, Raymond Tribus. There we go. We'll have you come up first.
And they did talk to me about changing the bill.
I had kind of been told them that they needed to do that. Thank you. Oh, and Dr. Robin Henderson, do you want them up here too at the same time? Or I'll just go with these two first. Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Linda Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Walden University. Walden is included in the Laureate International University System, a global network of 85 accredited campus-based and online universities in 29 countries, serving more than 950,000 students around the world. Walden, which is headquartered in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission North Central Association, one of six regional accrediting associations recognized by the U.S. Department of Education and the Council for Higher Education Accreditation. A 2012 U.S. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee report stated that, quote, Walden's performance, measured by student withdrawal and default rates, is perhaps the best of any company examined. And it appears that students are faring well at this predominantly graduate degree-based for-profit college, unquote. Until recently, Walden University offered a PhD program in clinical psychology in Oregon, as it still does in many states, including our neighboring states of California and Washington. Walden's program is a hybrid program combining online education with a number of intensive residential sessions. This structure provides a superior learning environment that permits non-traditional students, such as those who have jobs and families, or those who live in rural areas, to pursue an advanced degree. Walden students have been very successful in Oregon, passing the admission exams administered by the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners and becoming valued members of the psychology profession. However, recently, the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners limited entry to the psychology profession in Oregon to students who attend traditional brick-and-mortar institutions by amending its rules to require that only students who have completed psychology doctoral programs accredited by the American Psychological Association may take the Oregon admission exams and apply for a license to practice psychology. The APA explicitly states in its standards for accreditation that it will not accredit universities that are, quote, substantially online, unquote. The citation to the APA standard that I've just mentioned is in the written testimony that I have submitted. As a result of this APA requirement, Walden and any other schools that offer hybrid programs with a substantial online component cannot apply for accreditation by the APA. By limiting entry to the profession to students from APA-accredited programs, the OBPE has foreclosed the possibility of becoming a psychologist to very deserving students who do not have the ability to relocate for an extended period of time at an APA-accredited institution. Walden's student body is 52% ethnic minority, 75% female, and 89% of its students are already in the workforce. Many students who work toward the PhD in psychology degree are already working in counseling or other mental health professions, and they want to advance already existing careers. Many Walden students are located in rural areas that have an unfilled need for expert mental health providers. Although Walden still has some students in the pipeline who will be able to be licensed in Oregon under transitional rules, Walden has ceased accepting new Oregon students. We ask that the committee pass SB 418-2 so that Oregon residents will once again be able to have the same opportunity to pursue an education and a career in psychology as the residents of Washington and California do. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Dr. Raymond Tribus, and I am the Senior Director for Psychology Licensing and Regulatory Affairs at Walden University. In addition to the things that you've already heard, I'd like to make just a few additional points. The intent of the recent regulation changes by the Psychology Licensing Board have the effect of discriminating against our students and those who are similarly situated. And you've already heard something about the background, the population that we serve, largely minority, mostly women, many folks in small towns, rural communities, and these are mid-career folks. The average age of our students is between 39 and 40. So these are people with family obligations, job obligations, and so forth, and don't typically have the flexibility to move in pursuit of a APA-accredited program. One of the things that's important to know is that in not accrediting programs, doctoral programs that use online education, APA is an outlier compared to other similar institutions, accrediting institutions. Walden values programmatic accreditation, and just as examples, we hold accreditation in our program for mental health counseling, which is accredited by their group, in nursing, in education, in business, public health, information technology. And our relatively recently established social work program doesn't yet have accreditation, but is well along in that process. So none of those organizations bar institutions simply because they use online education, but the American Psychological Association does. Both in their current regulations and in the newly adopted regulations that they just adopted a month or 6 weeks ago, which go into effect in 2017. What we do at Walden and some other similar institutions is we follow the substance of what APA requires in a doctoral program. We teach the same courses. We have the same requirements for practicum and internship, which is applied supervised practice in the field. We have highly qualified faculty to the same standards that you would meet at other APA-accredited institutions. And we do, one of the requirements of APA is that 1 year of the doctoral program be, quote, in residence at the institution that grants the degree. We also do, both in our older version of program and in our current version, we do a year in residence, but we do it a little bit differently from traditional institutions. Traditional institutions might have classes every week over the course of a year. Given who we serve and where they live, we have done that in a condensed way so that we operate in a quarter system. So for four consecutive quarters, they have what's called the academic year in residency, and we do 9 days, intensive 9 days in residence, each of those four consecutive quarters, and they come together and do it during those 9 days each quarter. The total number of hours that they spend in class with each other and with faculty is slightly above what would be typical in a traditional university spread across a year. So it's very comparable in terms of the amount of time that they spend, just organized differently. So that we, and then in addition to that year in residence, we have four other residential events, one of which occurs before that year in residence, the other three mostly occur after, so that we really fulfill one of the primary reasons that APA requires a residency to begin with, which is what they call socialization into the profession and being able to both observe, evaluate, and influence the professional development of people as they go through their doctoral program. We do that, just do it in a different way from what is traditional. Just a couple of other points. One is that on the general issue of how well can online education work, I believe it was 2010, and it's referenced in some of the materials we distributed to you. The U.S. Department of Education conducted a meta-analysis, which is a way of summarizing a wide variety of studies. And these were studies comparing traditional face-to-face education and online or hybrid combined education. And their conclusion was that online or hybrid education was at least equal and in some cases slightly superior to traditional face-to-face education. So in terms of general available knowledge on the subject matter, there is no negative impact, certainly, if not perhaps a slightly positive one for using online educations. Another point that's important is that access to apply for licensing in Oregon allows our people, as they have in the past, to continue contributing to the state. And because our people tend to be place-bound, they are much more likely than average to stay where they are and serve the local communities where they're already situated. They have to take the same as any other applicant. They have to take the national examination and the state examination. They don't get licensed unless they pass it, which they have been doing successfully until now. So on the basis of all of those kinds of considerations, we would urge you to adopt this set of this bill, which would change the licensing regulations so that our graduates and others like them would continue to be able to apply for psychology licensing here in Oregon. And if there are questions, of course, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions, anyone? I guess my only question is if one of your students received a degree in California, right, and practiced in California for a year or two and then moved to Oregon, do they have a pathway to get certified in Oregon, or would this law preclude them from becoming licensed in Oregon after? I don't know if you know that answer, but I just...
Yeah, I don't know the exact answer. Many states have reciprocity agreements with other states. I'm not sure of the exact nature of the California and Oregon reciprocity, but many states do have that kind of reciprocity.
Chair Roblin, I'll try to attempt to answer that from memory. I believe that if you practice for a certain number of years in that other state, then you can apply without taking the examination.
Okay.
And it doesn't really matter what school you're from, I think.
Any other questions? No. Thank you very much. And we have Dr. Robin Henderson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. I come to you from the wild road of Highway 22 to come up here today and testify on this bill on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association. So thank you very, very much. I am a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon. I'm a graduate of George Fox University. And I attended George Fox before it was APA accredited. And at the time that I attended George Fox, they were working towards APA accreditation. And there were a few additional courses that I had to take so that I could meet the standards that the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners holds. And I just want to outline a few things about why the Oregon Psychological Association remains opposed to this bill. This is the third session that this has come forward. It's come forward twice, I think, as Senator Gelser knows. It's come forward twice in the House, and now it's coming before education here in the Senate. And in that time, they probably easily could have met the accreditation standards. The American Psychological Association isn't opposed to online and distance learning. In fact, the Fielding Institute, Alliant University, and many other APA-accredited institutions use online components for their educational programming. But the problem is APA also holds those institutions to standards that we believe in here in Oregon, standards that in our own law are upheld in, for instance, the American Psychological Association's ethical code, which combines all of Oregon's ethical codes for psychologists. We defer to the American Psychological Association. So it's not a trade association. It's a standards association. And that's where my concerns lie. Regional accreditation doesn't specify coursework, doesn't hold anybody accountable to the training that graduate programs require, and the American Psychological Association does. What their protection allows us is the ability to standardize and know the vetting of the types of providers that we're getting. That provides us a level of understanding of what people are really trained in and what they're capable of doing. The American Psychological Association also ensures that people are sufficiently prepared, which, again, allows us to have that APA ethical code. As an APA, you know, accredited institution, I had to take a lot of specific training in ethics so that I would be prepared to practice here in Oregon. Some of APA's accredited schools, as I said, are distance learning. And as a licensed psychologist in Oregon, it's really concerning to me that we're looking at lowering our standards for one for-profit, out-of-state college. And that really concerns me as an Oregon psychologist who practices here. Our current licensure procedures have been streamlined to take advantage of the vetting of candidates by APA, saving us tax dollars and making us have a more standardized and really accountable program. And we work very closely with the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. I would ask that Walden University work with OBPE to bring their standards up to our standards, and that we not lower our standards for someone from out of state who doesn't necessarily hold the value that we do. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
So you might be able to answer the question I asked them that they weren't sure about. If they had a program in Washington or California, mm-hmm. and they got their degree, and then they worked as a psychologist in those states for a number of years, and then moved to Oregon, would they be able to get a license here?
They would have to meet those standards, and so what I've seen when I've hired out-of-state graduates is that sometimes people have to take one or two courses or may have to show that they've had XYZ amount of hours of supervised experience. We actually hired someone from out-of-state who worked, who got their degree, and I can't remember exactly what school it was, but they were from out-of-state, and they had to do a period of supervision for a year as kind of like a residency. So the board's been able to work with that. I don't know the specifics of, say, California or Washington, because it really is dependent on your training, the length of time, and the quality of your residency.
So their standards are not the same as ours?
No, every state has the ability to set different standards. Many states do default to APA standards as a standardized accreditation, and that's helped them to be able to move forward with things like the ability to eliminate residency so that you can, like medical physicians, get licensed upon graduation and then do your supervision in the post-licensure phase. That's something that Oregon, I think, at some point needs to consider, because we do have the protection of APA.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Is there anyone else? That is all the people. Is there anybody else that wanted? Yes, come on up.
Chair Roblin, we had asked if we could refute some of the statements, because we had learned last year that
some of the statements were... If there's any information, go ahead.
Yes.
Again, Raymond Tribus from Walden University. Particularly the comments that were made about other online universities being accredited by APA, I think is not correct. Before coming to Walden 3 years ago, I was the dean of the School of Psychology at Fielding Graduate University that was mentioned, so I know their programs well. And before that, for a series of years, 9 years, I was the chancellor of the California School of Professional Psychology, which is now part of Alliant University, so I know that program well. The Alliant program uses certain courses online, but they are not a largely online institution, so that one is not a good comparison. Fielding Graduate University does what they call distance education, but they do it in a kind of individual British-style tutorial rather than formalized online classes the way that Walden does. Fielding got their initial accreditation from APA in 1991, before the opposition to these non-traditional approaches had really solidified within the American Psychological Association, and they've managed to keep it since then. Except that in any accreditation, once you are reaccredited for a certain period, they set the date for your next visit. And for APA, it's between 3 and 7 years. With one exception, the Fielding program has been given the minimum every time, so they have to go back for review every 3 years. One time they got 5 years, otherwise 3 and 3 and 3. So APA is clearly not very happy that they allowed one exception through, but there is that one exception at Fielding, but there are not others.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 418, and we will open a work session, a public hearing on, Senate Bill 895. And with that, Senator Steiner Hayward, do you want to come up with whoever you want to come with you?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton, also a family physician. Today I'm asking you to consider Senate Bill, the -3 amendments for Senate Bill 895. And Senate Bill 895, the -3 amendments are really, don't pay attention to the rest of 895. Just assume that what's in the dash threes matters. And the dash threes will do several things that we hope will both enhance parent awareness if their child is medically fragile about local immunization rates, and also enhance the ability to have true informed consent conversations between primary care providers and their patients when it comes to making decisions about immunizations. The first part, in terms of informing parents about local immunization rates, regards schools. And one of the things that we know is that although immunization rates for schools across the state are available on the Health Authority website, most parents aren't aware of that. And even if they are, they're a little tricky to find. So what this would do is several things. The first is that we would now include school immunization rates on the school report card. So for public schools, in addition to things like their test scores and graduation rates for high schools, it would also include their immunization rate. The second thing is that the schools would be responsible for notifying parents at their schools, both at the beginning of the school year and about a month after exclusion day, so the middle of March, about what the exemption rate is at this school, the non-immunization rate at that school. Now, why, may you ask, is this important? We know that in order to have what we call community immunity, to protect children who can't be immunized from very serious infectious diseases such as measles, there has to be a certain level of immunity among the rest of the population. And for things like measles, that's on the order of 94% of the population being immunized. Unfortunately, in large parts of Oregon, we're now seeing rates that are dipping down toward 92 or even lower. And that means that were a child with measles to come to school, first of all, it would just look like the common cold at the beginning, because a lot of diseases start looking exactly the same way. But while that child looked like they had a common cold, they would be highly contagious. Measles is so contagious that if 10 unimmunized people are in a room with somebody who has measles, 9 of them will get the measles. That's one of the most contagious diseases we have. And it's also a very hardy virus. It hangs around for up to 48 hours after it's spread in a room. So you don't even have to be in the same room. You just have to be there within 24 or 48 hours. So schools would be required to notify families at their school what the immunization rate is. And that could be done by paper. It could be done by an electronic communication. But it's important to give parents information so they can make an informed choice, and if they need to either talk about special protections for their child at that school or consider transferring for health reasons, which is already an option under Oregon statute, and that so we wouldn't be creating new problems around school transfer rules. This reason can be considered appropriate for an inter-district transfer. The second thing that this would do would be to change the rules about what you would have to do to get a non-medical exemption. In Oregon, we allow for non-medical or personal belief exemptions. And right now, to get a non-medical exemption, to do that, you either have to have a note signed by your child's primary care provider, a physician, a nurse practitioner, a PA, or a naturopathic physician, or you have to watch an online approved video module and print out a certificate. There was, as I'm sure you're all aware, a fair amount of debate about a previous immunization bill, and the debate circled around a couple of things. The first was parental choice, and the second was informed consent. And recognizing that this is something that many Oregonians feel strongly about, the changes in the 8-3 amendments of 895 address those two concerns. Parents would still be able to obtain a personal belief or non-medical exemption. However, because of the point of informed consent and because the courts have consistently ruled that it's impossible to obtain true informed consent from a video, parents would need to have that note signed by their child's primary care provider. And again, that could be their physician, nurse practitioner, PA, or naturopathic physician. So basically, we're just clarifying what you have to do to get a non-medical exemption. We're also adding an option to get to be on an approved catch-up schedule. So if you've chosen to delay certain immunizations, then you can continue to do that and still be considered, not be required to get a non-medical exemption. So that allows parents to space out immunizations should they so choose. And so we think that it addresses a lot of the concerns that were raised about 442, and it also protects the rights of parents who have medically fragile children or children who can't be immunized against certain diseases that are very contagious. We don't want to put those kids at risk. It also clarifies the ability of schools to exclude certain children if there's an outbreak of a known contagious disease that is one of the ones that would be preventable with immunization. I believe that covers the vast majority of it. It does say that if that pre-existing non-medical exemptions would have to be redone unless they were already done by having a note signed by your primary care provider. And I think that covers the main features of it.
One real quick question. So
certainly.
People who didn't have the chance to look at OLIS, it's up on OLIS now.
Yes, it is. The dash threes are on OLIS.
The difference between twos and threes, because I think they got the twos late.
Kept naturopathic physicians in.
Okay.
They are currently in statute, and the dash threes, which is the ones that we're asking you to consider, keep naturopathic physicians in as an option for any of the requirements.
Okay, we'll let the other two go and then we'll have questions.
Certainly. Aaron, you want to start?
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Aaron Dunn. I'm the manager of the Oregon Immunization Program in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to talk about current immunization requirements for school entry and child care facilities. Vaccinating the population serves a dual purpose. Immunizations protect the person being immunized. They also have the added benefit of creating community immunity, as the senator mentioned. You may have heard of this as herd immunity in the past. If enough people are vaccinated, we know that infection levels in that community will be reduced. The Oregon Immunization Program promotes evidence-based methods to increase vaccination levels in a community. One of these is a vaccination requirements for childcare, school, and college admission and enrollment. For the past 35 years, Oregon's immunization law has helped make sure that children go to school and childcare in a safe and healthy environment without outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases. The law requires documentation of immunization or exemptions upon new enrollment in school, childcare, preschool, or Head Start programs. Data is collected annually on the number of children up to date on immunizations, a number of children with exemptions, and the number of children incomplete in their immunizations and due for their next dose. Rates for schools and child cares are available in aggregate, but individual student information is kept confidential. All children's records are reviewed during the school year to identify missing immunizations, including children who are on catch-up schedules approved by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. ACIP is a group of medical and public health experts that develop recommendations on use of vaccines to control disease. The recommended and catch-up schedules are published each year by the Center of Disease Control and Prevention. Administrative Rule 333-050-0120 allows for children to be on the ACIP catch-up schedule and be in compliance with school and child care immunization requirements. As long as the ACIP's catch-up schedule is followed, the exemption is not needed currently. Parents choosing to vaccinate their children on a slower alternate schedule not recommended by ACIP are currently required to have an exemption for those vaccines being delayed. However, the exemption is then removed once the child has completed that series and documentation has been provided to the school or child care facility. Oregon's vaccine exemption rates have been increasing for 15 years now. The annual rate of vaccine exemptions for Oregon kindergartners have steadily increased from 2.4% in 2001-2002 to 7% in 2013-14. Some Oregon counties have a vaccine exemption rate as high as 16%. As the senator mentioned, that means that some areas of the state are really at risk in terms of their community immunity availability. To address this public health issue, the 2013, the legislature passed a new law changing the process for parents to claim a new vaccine exemption to school immunization requirements. This new law was implemented in 2014 and requires parents to claim a new exemption to get education about the benefits and risks of immunizations. They could receive that either by talking to their healthcare practitioner or, as she mentioned, reviewing the online vaccination education module. Preliminary data on the impact of that law would be available later this month. But as we await those results in Oregon, we know that Washington and California passed similar laws and saw 20 to 25% reductions in their immunization exemption rates. Those laws did include talking to their healthcare practitioner, but did not have the online module that we've had here in Oregon during the past year. I thank you for this opportunity to provide the testimony and would be happy to provide any additional information as needed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Beringer. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association, and we represent over 8,000 physicians, physician assistants, and medical students in the state. You have my written testimony, so I'll just make a couple of comments sort of building on what was said. We've heard the data is very clear. Oregon has the highest vaccination exemption rate in the country, and the trend line is moving in the wrong direction. This bill is simply about transparency. This is just another way to take data that is already collected in public and make sure it gets in the hands of the parents that need it most. As a parent, I'm always concerned about keeping my children safe. If I have a child with a compromised immune system, I would like to have a general idea of my school's immunization opt-out rate. In fact, it might not just be my child that I need to worry about. It could be a grandparent, a newborn, or someone else with a compromised immune system that I'm trying to protect when I'm deciding who will attend school events. Senate Bill 895 simply takes information that is already public and makes it easier for parents to access that information. Please support the legislation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Yes.
Senator yeah, panel. I just have a couple questions for Aaron. Aaron, when you when the state reports exemption rates, is it true that, like, if you have 20 out of 23 vaccines that you've already had done, but you have exemption for the three, is that then is that child counted as an exempt child under Oregon's reporting?
That's correct. It's one or more vaccines considers you as exempt.
Can I just add, Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, while that is counted as an exemption, there are actually breakdowns of each immunization and the number of children who've received them, and those are also available on the web, so that that information is parsed out a little bit more finely. So, yes, it could well be true that immunization exemption rates are, in theory, a little bit higher, but the they may appear a little higher than they actually are if some kids have had some but not all of their immunizations. But the data on the ones that are the most contagious are the ones that are showing the most exemptions.
And just a follow-up to Aaron. So do all states report that way in terms of kids that have been vaccinated for some vaccines but not for others? Do they count those as exempt as well? So is everybody reporting the same way?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I would say that there's quite a variation from state to state in both their reporting standards and just how they what they consider to be a non-medical exemption. So it really is quite a variety across the country.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Berchick.
You stated that, thank you, Chair Roblin, you stated that California and Washington did pass some laws so that they got more education out to the folks, but yet the immunization rates went down. Is that what you stated?
The exemption rates, if Mr. Chair, Senator Berchick, the exemption rates went down, but they only had what we're proposing now, which is the ability to get the exemption from directly from a health care provider, not the video version.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify this. The information that would then be available through the report cards or at the school, that's information that's already available if you know how to look for and find it. This would just make that same public information, and it's already broken down by school.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, yes, that's correct. And I would also point out, I have heard of some buzz that there's some concern about public shaming, whatever, and let me be crystal clear. These are aggregate numbers, and I would certainly entertain, and I think the health authority already does some work in very small schools about not doing that, because we do not want to pick out any particular family for making the choice not to immunize their children. We just want parents who have children or, as Mr. Beringer mentioned, medically fragile adults, people getting chemotherapy, or newborns who haven't been able to get their immunizations yet, because, for example, babies can't be immunized against measles until they're over a year old, that they would keep those kids away from events potentially if that school had a low aggregate immunization rate. So, yes.
Can I follow up?
Follow up, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just on this confidentiality issue, what if I had a, if I saw that my school, I looked at my report card, it had a high exemption rate and I had a medically fragile child, would that information be able to tell me which classrooms had the unimmunized kids, and would the school be able to tell me that, or would I just know about school events and know what that general rate was rather than by classroom?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, it would not be broken out by classroom, in part because that would be a greater risk of violating people's confidentiality, and we don't think that's appropriate, and in part because, as I mentioned, these diseases are so contagious that it doesn't really matter what classroom you're in, because, for example, if a child in the third grade is unimmunized and goes to school with the early stages of measles and is in the cafeteria, and then the fifth grade comes in for lunch, then that fifth grader is at risk of picking up the disease if he or she is medically fragile. So we do them by school because the vast majority of these diseases are very contagious, and it doesn't really matter by classroom, and also to protect family confidentiality.
And one more question on the confidentiality. Yes. Thank you. So on... when schools provide information about their assessments, that is broken down by demographic information, grade level, age, race, gender. Is this broken down by those demographics, or is it the entire school?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, no, this is the entire school. This is not broken down by those demographics. Those data are not collected in that way on the in terms of what's reported and made public. Those are available, but those are kept separately by the health authority, and that's not, we're only asking in this bill for the aggregate data for the school.
So I wouldn't be able to go in, for instance, and pick out that a student had not been immunized because they had a very specific set of demographic characteristics?
No, you, Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, you would not. I would say, if I might, that as a family physician and as a parent, I encourage parents to talk to other families about issues of concern to them. I have teenagers, and if my teenager says, can I go over to Annie's house for a party, I'm going to be on the phone to Annie's parents saying, hey, do you guys know that Annie's offering a party, and are you going to be home and present and around? Because I want to be sure my child is safe, and that's my values. When my children were little, I asked different questions about parental supervision. I think parents could on a personal basis ask a question of another parent that their child was likely to be in close contact, but that's not the state's business. That's a parent's right. And if a school parent knows that their school has a lower rate and they're okay with keeping their child there but have some level of concern because at the moment somebody in their family is ill, they should know that they might want to ask a question of another parent. But that's between parents. We're only talking about aggregate data. It is very important to have this not be about shaming, but about community conversations and about parental awareness, because we have an increasing number of children who have medical conditions. We have an increasing number of adults who are, thank God, being successfully treated for cancer but have suppressed immune systems because of chemotherapy, and they need special levels of protection. And this kind of aggregate awareness will be able to protect more people in that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to get an understanding. I've had a lot of email about confidentiality, and I'm trying to figure out what those protections are. If there's an 85% vaccination rate, 15% exemption rate, if there's anything in that data that would help identify those 15%, and I'm not hearing that there is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gelser, to the best of my knowledge, there is not, and I would not support anything that would allow any child to be individually identifiable. I simply want aggregate data to educate parents.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the school's exemption rate, Aaron, does the school's exemption rate take into consideration adults that are on the school campus?
Senator Roland, members of the committee, I would say that doesn't take into account that exemption rate at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, under Oregon law, it is illegal for an employer to require employees to be immunized as a condition of their employment. And so we are not allowed to require teachers to be immunized or other staff members to be immunized. We can encourage it, and we certainly do, but we cannot require it under state law. This is equally true, for example, in hospitals where we're not allowed to require staff members to be immunized against influenza. That's a matter of state law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So we have a large list of people who want to testify and not as much time. So we are going to use a timer for the rest of the people. It's 2 minutes. Most people can get what they need to say and done in 2 minutes, but I just want to make sure that we announce that. So next we have Josh Balak, Sarah Basler, and Doug Barber. Jim, if you want to pull a chair up, you can come up. Jim, James Barber can also come up if you want to pull your table up, and then we'll get going to the others.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association to speak in support of Senate Bill 895 with the Dash 3 amendments. We think this bill takes important steps to improve Oregon's childhood immunization rate, as well as adding transparency measures about vaccination rates that will let parents make the right choices for their families. ONA is proud to represent over 13,000 Oregon nurses, nurse practitioners, and nursing students. Our members work in a variety of healthcare settings, from large hospitals to small clinics to community-based public health. As nurses, our members are dedicated and have dedicated their careers to keeping people healthy and caring for the sick. One of the core policy principles that we support is prevention. Preventing a condition is always better than having to cure something, both from a health perspective as well as from a cost perspective. Vaccination is a key part of a prevention strategy, and ONA has historically supported efforts to increase the vaccination rate. ONA's shared concern with many other public health and provider organizations about Oregon's highest in the nation non-medical exemption rate. We see this as a reason to worry and ultimately a reason for the legislature to take the action that's before you today in Senate Bill 895. This legislation maintains a parent's ability to opt out of vaccines, but by requiring a healthcare provider to sign off on a non-medical exemption, ensures that there is communication that's based on the best possible information available that's grounded in science. The transparency piece of this is really key for parents to make the right choices for their families, and that may be a family who has a child who can't be vaccinated for a medical reason, or a family who has a small baby at home who's too young to be vaccinated. We think the transparency coupled with the conversations with a provider is a really important thing that this legislature should do, and we urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Perfect timing. Next.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. We represent about 5,000 family physicians across the state here in support of Senate Bill 895 with the Dash 3 amendment. You've heard about the high exemption rate in our school. There are more than 3,000 Oregon kindergartners who currently are not fully vaccinated. Children who are not immunized directly contribute to the resurgence of communicable diseases that are almost entirely preventable. They create those weak links in the public health system that put other people at risk. So at a minimum, we believe that parents should have the information about immunization rates at their children's school, and ask you to support this bill and amendment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Balak representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. COHO is an organization that works with other organizations who work with 8 of our 16 CCOs across the state. Our CCOs, as we've been getting up and running, have been partnering with public health in a myriad of ways to improve health for our communities, a couple examples being helping expecting moms and doing smoking cessation programs. The bill and the amendment help ensure that public health and our local providers can focus on efforts to improve the health of the community as opposed to fighting easily preventable diseases. We also support the legislation just because we think it's the right thing to do. Just as a personal story, a few years back I was sitting around the table with my dad and my little girl, who was 5 years old at the time, and he was telling a story about how he had had polio and spent 6 years learning to walk again. And my little girl asked the question, "What is polio?" And I got to look her right in the eye and say, "Something you never have to worry about." And it's bills like this that are going to help ensure that other fathers can have the same conversations with their daughters for years to come. So we hope you support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon.
And we're working to make Oregon the very best place to be a kid. We strive to make positive change by advancing policies that improve the health of children throughout the state, and this bill clearly will do that. The science, as has been represented already, is clear, and as a data-driven organization, we could throw a bunch of more numbers out about how the median exemption rate across the country is 1.7%, but here in Oregon, it's at 7%. We don't need to be last in that. We need to help our children be healthy. And I know you hear from people with various viewpoints, but a correlation does not mean causation. The science, however, shows that these changes will help the lives of children, and that's why Children First is strongly supportive of this measure and urges you to support it as well. Thank you.
Thank you all. Any questions for this group? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, you talked about outbreaks. What outbreaks are we suffering under right now?
Senator Roblin, Senator Cruz, certainly the most recent was the measles outbreak nationwide.
The one case in Oregon.
There's also public health, I believe, at the earlier hearing talked about a whooping cough, which is a growing concern in the state. I'm not a public health expert. They're the ones who could best answer that question.
Well, additional question.
Yes.
Could anybody on this panel explain to me why hepatitis B vaccine should be given at birth? I asked the question because it's spread either by sex or blood, so newborns very seldom are having sex. So the whole reason for that question, Mr. Chair, is this is CDC guidelines, okay? And which is what we're trying to mirror as CDC guidelines. And CDC, in my opinion, on many levels, is somewhat of an inept organization and maybe somewhat corrupt. So I guess I'm wondering why we're blindly following something from an organization that I'm not sure really knows what they're doing. I didn't expect an answer.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would just mention, as a parent, I've been receiving alerts. We have a pertussis outbreak in my kids' high school, multiple kids with pertussis, and it's the third time this year that we've gotten alerts that we're involved.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Holly Garland, Amy Doerr, and Preston Oliver. And we've got four chairs. No, we got three, so we'll go with the three. He had to take his chair back. Thanks. Now we're fine.
Okay.
And Holly can go first, I guess. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Holly Garland, and I am a U.S. Navy veteran. Thank you for your time. I don't appreciate anybody trying to take away my rights or my children's rights. We are the sovereign owners of our bodies. The MMR, as they stated earlier, the other experts, pro, said that if I wanted to space them, I would still be listed on there. That's really shouldn't be. A large body of evidence about the adverse events and lack of efficacy of vaccinations has not been discussed at all. When has any amount of aluminum, mercury, or thimerosal ever been good for anyone? Reporting this would cost a lot of money. They haven't even talked about that. That would be a huge waste of taxpayer funds towards education. Vaccines are a medical procedure. SSB 895 is 442 by another number, and that is all it is. SB 895 is completely unethical. Oregon's vaccination rate for community immunity is well above the CDC's optimal level of 90%. Vaccinated people shed viruses. By the way, Senator Cruz, thank you for your comment about getting Hep B. When I said that I didn't want that, my own pediatrician just exploded at me. And I said the same thing that you did. And she basically just went off on me. What doctor would sign this exemption after this bill was passed? If it was passed, it would be career suicide. you would be forcing a parent's hand. Is Oregon going to pay for every single doctor visit when a parent wants a medical exemption? I have to pay those bills. Oregon doesn't. Those numbers that they said that are up on the web, they only recently came up, and they're only for kindergartners. So it's useless again. When are the medically fragile people going to come to my child's school? I mean, these people who have chemo, wouldn't they be home? Wouldn't they be too weak? You know, if unless you have AIDS or chemo, those are the only exemptions that I know of from not getting a vaccination for this bill. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi. I must have done something wrong because I wasn't aware that my name was going to be called. Oh. So. So I'll just make a super quick.
I had a list.
I thought we were just signing in that we were here.
Congratulations.
So to me, this is sort of a medical issue, and I'm not entirely sure how it pertains to education. I mean, I understand releasing exemption statuses on report cards, how that relates to education, but the portion of the bill that relates to how exemptions are obtained does not seem like an education issue to me. And that's the portion of the bill that I have the biggest issue with. It undermines the doctor-patient relationship on a technicality, basically. So.
Thank you. You did fine. Yeah, that's right.
Hi, Preston Oliver. I'm just going to piggyback on what my co-panelists said, that it seems odd to have this amendment and this bill with the amendment slipped into the educational committee here. And I'd hate to think that it was an effort to railroad something through that is clearly meant to be a medical, to be studied by the medical committee, with all respect to you, ladies and gentlemen, on the education committee. So benign as Senator Senator Hayward indicates, it would be, I'd hate to think again that it would be a slippery slope that introduces this this bill and the thoughts behind it to then build toward a more robust immunization, forced immunization bill. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, question. Hold on a second. You get to have an opportunity for a question.
Yeah. Yes, to the First Lady who spoke, you posed a question that I'd like to answer, and your question was, what about my rights? And I would answer that with a question of my own. What about my rights to send a first grader to school in an environment where I know he is safe and not going to contract measles, diphtheria, mumps, pertussis, smallpox? I have rights too. Parents have rights too. We don't give people the right to go 150 miles an hour on the freeway for the benefit and the common good of others. That's how this works. So I'm answering that question to you.
Okay, well, I will answer it right now.
Well, you ask the question, and I'm posing it back to you.
Well, I will pose an answer for you.
You have a chance to.
Is this now the time?
Your turn.
The individual rights are not superseded by the public rights. The first and largest or smallest body is the individual. Your public rights don't trample over my individual rights or my child's at all. I was in the U.S. Navy, and I was in a microcosm. And you cannot tell me that since we had one person in Oregon get the measles, he was around plenty of people. How come we don't have hundreds? It's across the U.S. I'm sorry, the science just doesn't validate that argument.
Well, there will be people who disagree with that.
That's right.
Well, they probably haven't done the research then.
So, any other questions? I see none. Thank you very much. And to answer Senator Cruz's question, we'll have another person, Senator Steiner Hayward, come up, because she wanted to answer your questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, again, Elizabeth Steiner, Hayward, Senate District 17. My understanding is that Senator Cruz asked a question about the need for hepatitis B immunization at birth that the panel that was up current at that time was unable to answer. And if I may, I'd like to try to answer that question for you, Senator, which is a valid question. That immunization was recommended at birth because there is a lot of maternal fetal transmission of hepatitis B. Now, if we know for a fact that the mother is not hep B positive, then it is reasonable to delay that immunization. And then you might ask, why do we have to do it in childhood? But the reality, Senator, is that hepatitis B is transmitted in a boatload of different ways. It, too, is a fairly hardy virus. A lot of people who are hepatitis B positive don't actually know that they're chronic carriers of hepatitis B, so they can be shedding the virus in very small ways. A few years ago, I was traveling with my kid. I got a viral infection, and my daughter, who was traveling with me, used the wrong toothbrush. Guess who got sick next? And the reality is kids get hepatitis B that way, too. From relatives who don't know that they're hepatitis B positive, there are a lot of other ways that people get hepatitis B other than IV drug use or sexual activity, Senator. And so protecting children, because we know that if children contract hepatitis B, their risk of liver cancer or chronic liver failure is dramatically higher than when adults get hepatitis B. So this is a very, very serious illness. Is it common? No, it's not. It's not nearly as common as measles or chickenpox or things that we consider common childhood illnesses. But is it really, really serious? Yes, it is. And that's why we recommend that immunization in early childhood, Senator. I hope that answers your question. And then if I may, And if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Haas posed a question and one of the witnesses made a comment about it. I would comment that there is extensive Supreme Court precedent about requiring immunizations for school attendance, dating back to 1905. And the courts have been very consistent about that ever since, that the public good around immunizations in this case does outweigh the individual liberty. And that being said, there is nothing in the Dash 3 amendment that would prevent a parent from being able to make their personal choice not to immunize their child. They would still have the right and the opportunity to obtain a non-medical exemption. It would just simply require a conversation with their primary care provider and a note from that provider to that effect. So those individual rights would not be trampled. It would simply require what we hope is going on an ongoing basis already, which is informed consent conversations about immunizations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we'll have Hillary Andrews, Sarah Soltani-Gilbert, and David Sawyer. Hope I got those all similar, close to what they are. And we will have enough time for at least, it looks like, maybe one more panel. And we are going to have another public hearing and or work session if this bill continues. So we will keep the list of anybody whose name's on here. I looked early, and I didn't find anybody that was over 100 miles, which is a requirement that we have give them a first chance. So we will keep the list and if there's a further one. So with that, go right ahead.
Hello, Chair Roblin. Education Committee, my name is Dr. Hillary Andrews. It's a pleasure to be here today. I am here representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. And I want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for addressing our concerns with respect to the Dash 3 amendment and making sure that naturopathic physicians have the ability to sign off both on medical and non-medical vaccine exemptions. Naturopathic physicians are recognized as primary health care physicians here in the state of Oregon. We serve as primary health care physicians to thousands of Oregonians. We are pro-vaccine and we increase vaccination rates. It is vital that we be able to write off, sign off on both medical and non-medical vaccine exemptions. That's all I have to say here today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Dear Senators of the Education Committee, my name is Sarah Soltani-Gobay, and I'm constituent of District 17. I am before you today in opposition of SB 895 with the Amendment 3 that we just found out about this afternoon. I was responding to Amendment 2, and so you have my testimony before you, and that is now irrelevant because I was trying to fight for my son's ability to be able to have his naturopath sign off on his exemption. So instead, I'd like to make a few other comments based on some of the testimony from earlier, which is that there are no longer checks and balances in this country, and that parents are all that remain in this regard, which is why regulatory agencies like the CDC are trying to eliminate our authority. Removing the education model module before the figures are even in to show whether or not it's working. Herd immunity that the senator likes to bring up as a benefit to the public by decreasing a parent's ability to obtain a non-medical exemption is a theory based on naturally acquired immunity. It is a theory. St. Jude has posted on their website, avoid live virus vaccines in people who have recently received one, as some vaccines are made from live viruses. Currently, these include oral polio, varicella, chickenpox, MMR, and nasal flu vaccines. These children are not required to miss school, despite the possibility of shedding. A side effect of the MMR is atypical measles. The MMR vaccine has co-infected an entire generation of children with a more virulent transforming strain of the primary pathogen called atypical measles syndrome. The medical industry has reluctantly confirmed this vaccine-derived mutation circulating throughout the environment. Herd immunity is also like saying all the houses in the neighborhood have security systems, so I don't need to lock my doors because I'm protected too. That is all I have to say. Thank you for your time.
David?
Senators, thank you for being here today. My name is David Sawyer. I'm a former research scientist with NASA, former elected mayor, and former city council member. I think that this is a very complex issue, from Senate Bill 442 to 763 that will come before other committees on dentists becoming involved in vaccination. I think that you have issues here to balance parental rights with your respect for doctors. And I think that's a tough one to measure, especially when you're not the health committee. This is an education committee. And I'm going to task you to consider really doing education. Because what I've seen from the time I walked into the House chamber 2 months ago to testify is we don't know the topic. The 1905 court decision in Jacobson versus the U.S. Supreme Court narrowly defined the ability of the state to get involved in immunization relative to a serious outbreak of smallpox that happened right then. Just that one case is so complex to unpack to tell us direction today of what we should be doing. We now have 11 diseases, 65 vaccines, and all the different kind of kids in our school system. And we're basically saying what the CDC is saying, we're going to treat them all the same. It's bad science. I think it's bad public policy. Get involved with education. Help teach people about the National Vaccine Court, the 3,000 cases and the $3 billion settled for people who have been damaged permanently by vaccines, the tens of thousands who have reported in the vaccine adverse reaction studies. That's the education. The pending federal lawsuit in Philadelphia against Merck by their own virologists. We're not hearing that information. Help us. Amend the bill to create real education about the vaccine issue in our state and in our country. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last panel for the day, David Sawyer. No, that was David right then. Nora Brock. Sherry Clark. And Michael King.
While everybody else is coming up here, if it's okay for you guys to save your time, I'll get started. Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Michael King. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a registered nurse. I have 3 children at home and a 4th on the way, so point being, I do care about child health. And I oppose SB 895 and the -3 amendment. While I understand this is the Education Committee, as Senator Hayward has decided to reapproach SB 442 under the guise of the educational system, I'm forced to discuss health care with you instead of education. This bill, with significant changes to the language, attempts to remove the education module established via SB 132 back in 2013. significant problems with this proposed amendment. First, the education module is uniform. It ensures the standard of vaccine education from family to family remains unchanged, and that cannot be said when left in the hands of each and every individual doctor or clinic. This legislation does not provide educational materials, but simply instructs healthcare practitioners to teach their patients information that they may or may not have readily on hand to teach at that time. Instead of using a quality standard that was devised 2 years ago, we'll be adopting a substandard varied educational practice that has really no oversight to ensure practitioners are providing sufficient teaching. The education module has been the solution for the past 2 years, and really nothing has changed in this state, medically or otherwise, to suggest a lower standard of education would be better advised. Second, this puts undue burden on families to have to pay for additional doctor visits. Now, under the Affordable Health Care Act, doctor schedules are already extremely full. So creating additional physician visits instead of using an already functioning education module created by our taxpayer dollars creates further stress on our burdened medical system and really basically says that the education model is a waste of money, and I don't believe it is. Third, this new system puts inordinate power in the hands of physicians. What happens if a physician refuses to sign the document stating they provided education? No one's able to force physicians to sign, and if the document goes unsigned, the parent's out of compliance. If the PCP refuses to sign the documents, who else can parents turn to? There are no provisions outlined under this bill to address such an obvious problem. When that parent's out of compliance, the child is unable to attend the education that they deserve and their family's tax money pays for. I say if, but it's really a matter of when this occurs. Physicians in the state nationwide are already refusing service to patients who decline immunizations, even if they've been long-standing patients prior to opting out. This is actually a form of discrimination, and this bill only supports further medical discrimination. As honorable members of this committee who support education and want all children to have access to education, is a bill that creates discrimination something you are willing to support?
Okay. I have to ask you to sum up really quickly.
Okay, certainly. Basically, there's no grievance process. There's no penalty for physicians refusing to fulfill their duty to sign such paperwork. And it really is it's an overt manipulation of medical freedom. As a nurse, I certainly stand for my patients' medical freedoms, and that's paramount. Basically, in closing, this bill was already defeated once in a committee actually designed to address these issues. Again, no offense to you, ladies and gentlemen. It was pulled because it didn't receive sufficient senatorial support because senators listened to their constituents. Nothing has changed in the past 2 months, and we all still oppose SB 442, or rather, the new version titled SB 895 with the -3, probably soon to have -4 coming out in the next 20 minutes, amendment. Please strike this bill down. Thank you.
If you have asked if you can a little quicker, because we have another committee that comes up here in 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
Chairman Roblin, my name is Robert Snee. I'm an attorney living in Portland, and I'm also the director of Oregonians for Medical Freedom, coalition of over 2,000 members that vehemently oppose Senate Bill 895 and the -2 amendments. I previously submitted written testimony against the original amendment, and I want to address the -2 amendment. In 2013, Senate Bill 132 became law and eliminated the specific religious exemption for mandatory vaccines and requires anyone who wishes to claim an exemption for any non-medical reason, including religious reasons, to obtain a signature from a healthcare professional or watch the online education module. That law also specifically grandfathered all the prior religious exemptions and put no greater burden on those people for exercising their religious rights. In 2013, there were 32,000 exemptions on file in Oregon. This last-minute proposed amendment to Senate Bill 895 would eliminate that online education module without any feedback on the effectiveness of it, and also eliminate the grandfathered religious exemptions required those families to incur a financial burden of obtaining a doctor's signature on a new exemption form. Proposed Amendment 2 clearly interferes with the burdens and rights of religion and conscience as defined under Article 3, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution. Provides that no law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interference with the rights of conscience. Senate Bill 132 was specifically requested by the Oregon Pediatric Society with the intention of making the vaccine exemption process more burdensome on parents, not to ensure parents are more educated. Senate Bill 895-2 follows through on that same philosophy of making it more burdensome, both financially and time-wise, for people to claim an exemption with the hopes of increasing vaccination rates. It's not an attempt to better educate parents before exercising their rights to informed consent. If education was a goal, requiring a full explanation of the risks and benefits of vaccines and the risks of not vaccinating should be required not only of those claiming an exemption, but for those who elect to vaccinate as well. Informed consent should consist of a full disclosure of all the risks of vaccines, as indicated on vaccine package inserts, not the watered-down CDC-approved inserts, which fail to mention the most severe potential adverse effects from vaccines. With four federal studies pointing out that the CDC has become a captive agency with a revolving door between the administrators and the industry it's supposed to regulate, the agency has failed to serve the interests of the people of Oregon and the country. With Oregon, the vaccine adverse event reporting system indicates that Oregon has had over 248 serious adverse consequence reports since 1990 when the system was put in place. Based on Oregon's birth rate, the serious consequences from adverse effects from vaccines in Oregon is over one for every 4,500 children receive a serious reaction to vaccines, not the one in a million that is constantly quoted by those who are in favor of this legislation.
I'm going to ask you so the other person gets a chance because we are past our time. Send that in writing as well.
I will do that.
Thank you
so much for your time. I'm Jonathan Handley from Portland, Oregon. I wanted to raise a couple of quick comments about some things the bill sponsor said. Firstly, California and Washington do have the medical provider statute, but you can look at the form online. They also have religious exemptions, which this legislation isn't contemplating. And so to say that they're the same, they're not the same at all. There is no religious exemption contemplated in this law, so they're totally different from California and Washington. The point raised by my fellow citizen here, no one has asked a question from this panel on whether or not medical providers can refuse the appointment. You're talking about someone who could drive 50 miles, spend $200 on an appointment, listen for an hour, and then unless you guys mandate otherwise, the medical provider could refuse to sign the form even though they'd given them the education. That's an effective mandate. So if you're going to have a policy, make sure that the policy allows the citizens to actually get the form signed. The data is not provided by vaccine for exemption rates the way that the bill sponsor represented. It's kindergartners in the most recent year, but the data is really spotty. I've tried to crunch it. It's missing tons of it, so you can't do anything with it. Pertussis outbreak, Senator Gelser, the pertussis vaccine is known to fail at a very high rate. Read any article about a pertussis outbreak, and it's typically 75% vaccinated kids. So the one thing I can guarantee you is that there will always be pertussis outbreaks unless the vaccine changes. That's also true for measles. So they use pertussis over and over again to foment fear, but what's really true is the vaccine fails, and that's very easily searchable. Are you guys, as the Education Committee, really going to mandate schools display vaccine exemption rates on their websites and send them to parents, but not do the same for standardized test scores? I would ask you, are you an Education Committee or a Health Committee? In 2014, according to the OHA, 32,000 children utilized the personal belief exemption. Okay, now I know the confusion. There's 32,000 unimmunized children, as Senator Knope spelled out. That's not true at all. What's actually true is that a child who got 22 out of 23 vaccines would be considered unimmunized. The bill sponsor has continually asserted that there's been a pernicious rise in vaccine exemption rates in Oregon, which is absolutely true. But the Oregon Health Authority spelled out in a report that they generated based on the bill sponsor's own initiative, Senate Bill 722. Here's what the Oregon Health Authority said. When other vaccines have been added as school immunization requirements, non-medical exemption rates have increased for all vaccines. We've added significant numbers of vaccines since 2000, including Hep A that neither Washington nor California mandate right now. In fact, Hep A is only 20 states in the entire United States. So part of why we're seeing exemption rate rises because we're adding vaccines to the schedule. So let's be clear about that.
Because the other committee's already here.
So. Let me finish one thing. Informed consent. Here's the CDC form for the flu shot. Here's what actually comes in the vaccine. From the vaccine, it says flu shot has not been tested in children under 3 years of age. CDC form says nothing. If you're going to pass this bill, please define informed consent to include the package insert, 33 inches long, is given to every single parent. No one gets these inserts. They've never seen them. And when you ask a doctor for them, they get really mad at you. How can you give a drug and not provide the risks and benefits? That's the biggest problem with this bill right now. None of you have asked questions about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One quick clarification.
Yeah. We actually do require schools to post their assessment data, the numbers of kids by grade that are meeting, exceeding, or not meeting benchmark. We also require districts to report the specific numbers of seclusion and restraint, and we break that down by demographic data.
Is it on their website? Because I couldn't find mine anywhere. Okay, then I take that back. I apologize. Thank you.
And with that, I'm sorry we're not going to do the post. Is that okay?
What?
I just want to make sure that for the record that, we're going to close the public hearing, on Senate Bill 895. And vote, do you want to vote?
I'm fine.
Okay. And with that, we're going to close our Senate Education Committee.
I got this side of the dais.
Wow. I got a long walk.
I got this side of the dais.
Wow.